Hello and welcome to The Tidal Year, the podcast that discovers the joys of swimming. My name's Freya and joining me today is Seren Jones. She's a former competitive swimmer and one of the co-founders of the Black Swimming Association. She joined me to talk about her documentary, Black Girls Can't Swim, inclusion in the sport, and having big dreams. Enjoy! Before we dive into this episode, I'd like to thank today's sponsor, TryHard. I love being in the water, but I don't love what pool chemicals like chlorine do for my skin and hair. TryHard develop water sports specialized skin and hair solutions that eliminate those negative effects of pool chemicals and ocean salts. I'm thrilled to share with all listeners of The Tidal Year a very exclusive 15% off when you use code TIDAL at tryhard.co. Seren, thank you so much for joining me. Now, being on a podcast isn't new for you, as I know you're a journalist and a podcast producer. But as well as that, you've also swam competitively and you're a founder of a charity. So how do you identify when you're at a party? Tell me how you introduce yourself and answer the question, what do you do?
That's such a good question. I usually laugh and then I'm like, I have two jobs. I feel as though people who have two jobs have to like, it's quite normal to kind of work in retail or in hospitality and do something else. But when I kind of start elaborating about my work, because I'm really lucky to love what I do, people are a bit like, how do you find time to do it all? So it's a bit of both. It's like, I'm a journalist, but if you talk to me for long enough, I'll also be like, I have a charity and that's my baby and I love it. So it just kind of depends on like how far into conversation we get, I guess.
Before we talk about the charity, we should probably start with your journey and your history as a swimmer, because I suppose that's where it all began. So tell me, how old were you when you started swimming? What are your earliest memories of that?
So competitive swimming, aged 8, that was in Cardiff. And I absolutely used to hate competitive swimming for all the same reasons people hate swimming today. You have to jump into a cold pool, changing rooms are dirty, there are plasters and like hairballs floating on the surface of the water. It's disgusting if you're a germ freak. And I wasn't very good at it. So I didn't really like swimming, to be completely honest. And even before then, my parents would get my sister and I in the water just to learn how to be safe. We're a year apart, but we were kind of brought up as twins, so we did everything together. But again, I just never really remember liking swimming. I remember being scared of the water. I remember my sister swimming off into the distance and me like not letting my dad go because of all the reasons that I just listed before. And it's a very unfamiliar environment. I think when you're a kid, we forget that there's so much happening on a pool deck. You've got strangers who are half naked, like walking, if not running past you. You've got lifeguards blowing whistles. There's this foreign smell, all these different textures. So it's quite a lot actually for a child to like be immersed in this environment and then expect them to enjoy it and be happy as well. So I've been in the water for a very long time and I feel like I've gone through all the emotions really.
That's not what I was expecting you to say. I was expecting you to say, oh, I was a water baby and I loved it straight away. But you're right. Swimming is a very intense experience. And like you say, the textures and smells as well, especially the smell of a swimming pool, that like heady, chlorinated smell. And I suppose we kind of go through a phase as children where we hate it and it feels a bit difficult. Then we begin to love it. Then kind of in our teenage years, I definitely went back to that of hating it, finding it very intense, difficult with my hair, my contact lenses, having my body out. But I suppose there must have been a time when you loved it, or was it more that you were bonded with it because you were swimming with your sister?
No, it's actually the former. I loved it. Once I got past the stage of disliking, you know, all those horrible things that I listed when I was 8, and I started enjoying the activity, that's when it all changed for me. So I wasn't particularly good for a long time, but I'm a really competitive person, which is a blessing and a curse. And I was much better at like all the dry land sports, to be completely frank, all the sports where you see black people thrive. So like athletics, hockey, netball, gymnastics, I all took to them much more naturally. But swimming bugged me because I wasn't good. And I was like, I want to be good at this thing that I'm not physically good at, because I was good at sports. That was my thing as a child. I didn't feel like I was good at education until later on. So swimming was this challenge that I accepted head on. And I loved it. And as I got older and I went into my teens, that love, I was very fortunate to continue to grow. I had very supportive parents who bought into my dream of being an Olympic champion, which never happened, but that's okay. And it just grew and grew and grew until I got to that point of puberty where you see a lot of girls, like you were saying, kind of have these struggles and problems when it comes to their bodies changing and their skin and their hair and appearances becoming, you know, such a priority, that my love for swimming trumped all of that. You know, I stuck at it and I ended up retiring at 22. So, you know, it's the huge part of my life. I've been a swimmer for longer than I haven't been a swimmer still at this point, and I'm, you know, 28. So the love for swimming that I had was really true, was really pure. I often describe it as my first love, actually. Like, it was a love-hate relationship, but it's something that I can never really walk away from, and it gave me so much. So I'm very grateful for that.
You mentioned there that it's okay that you weren't an Olympic medalist. Does that feel okay with you? It sounds like that was a real dream. What was that journey like?
Oh my God, it's so random. When I was a kid, I was such a big dreamer. Like, people used to laugh at me. I was so easily influenced because I'd watch like Freaky Friday with Lindsay Lohan. I'd be like, that's it. I want to get like guitar lessons. Or I'd watch The Guardian with Kevin Costner and Ashton Kutcher. I'd be like, I want to be in the Coast Guard. Like, I was just so easily influenced. So when I realized I loved swimming, instantly I was like, I want to be an Olympic champion. And the dream, to be very precise, Freya, was to go to the Olympics for Team GB, swim the 100 butterfly, win gold, then go on Strictly Come Dancing because I'd be famous by then, and then model for M&S. Like, I don't know why I had all these like crazy thoughts when I was a kid, but that was the trajectory I was aiming for. And yeah, it didn't happen. I got to 15, which is where I peaked, and I couldn't really maintain the trajectory that I was on. And I had a really rough 2.5 years where not only was my performance and times plateauing, but, you know, as it was taking a mental toll, my time has actually started getting slower, which is really damaging for swimmers. You know, you're putting in like all these hours. I was training 9 times a week, 3 times before school, training in the gym, in the pool, doing all this yardage, competing. And when you don't see it pay off, it's absolutely heart-wrenching. So yeah, it was really difficult, but I stuck at it because the love was still there. And I was also very fortunate. My dad, he was also an athlete. He was a footballer, and he went to university in America to do his PhD. So even though I really wanted to be an Olympian, I was really lucky to have my dad at home, who would always say, if you don't make it, there's always another avenue. Like, it doesn't mean you failed. And that other avenue was getting a scholarship to go to America and having my university degree paid for. And that's essentially what I did. So I say it's okay I didn't make the Olympics because my quote-unquote backup dream came true. And when you look at the retention rate of Olympians, which is, you know, I find really sad that Olympians work their entire lives for 1 or 2 Olympic cycles, and then society in a way like moves on and forgets about them if they retire. Whereas I got to go to America, I got a degree, I had the best experience, I met my best friend, and I will always have that. So in a weird way, I feel like I won, like it wasn't meant to work out that way. So I'm really grateful.
That was a film, I would watch that film.
Oh,
including the M&S campaign at the end. But I think that's so, the path and the journey to the dream gave you a new one, which is amazing. And I read that actually silver medalists are the most resilient of all competitive sports people, because you have to get used to, you know, quote unquote failing and continuing to push yourselves and being courageous and not giving up. And I can't imagine what that's like to put yourself out there and be trying all the time.
Yeah.
What was life like as a competitive swimmer? You mentioned there was the gym all the time. How many days were you swimming? Did you have to be careful with what you were eating? It must have been a really all-consuming.
All-consuming is exactly what it was. From the age of 10, I started swimming before school. And in Cardiff, that meant setting an alarm for 5:11. That was when our alarm would go off every Wednesday at the time, 5:11. Get up. I have the best dad in the world, because he was the parent who would drive us to the majority of our practices, and mum would step in when he was away, but dad did the early mornings. So, you know, it's very, very demanding, swimming, probably one of the most demanding sports you can get. So by the time I finished my career in Cardiff when I was 18, just before I left to go to New York, I was swimming 9 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday before school, every night and Saturday morning. Then when I went to New York, everything kind of changed. It was really fascinating. Naturally, I was a sprinter. So I joined this program at university, which was a sprint program, which meant that the meters that I was swimming actually dropped. They reduced significantly. And the sessions I was doing in the weights room in the gym increased. So I was lifting weights properly for the first time. I was doing powerlifting, Olympic lifting. We were doing interval training in the pool. We were using literal weights in the water. You know that video that came out recently after Black Panther 2 of Lupita Nyong'o doing the water training when she's like lifting the weights and stuff? That's literally what I was doing at uni. You know, like it was phenomenal training. It was really, really difficult, but so enjoyable. And when I got to uni, that's also when diet became very important. You know, we would have our body measurements taken on a monthly basis to see how much we were growing, how much muscle we were gaining or losing, how much fat we were kind of shedding or not. And, you know, we would really think about what we were putting into our bodies. So we would have our bodies fine-tuned. We had a couple of psychology sessions where we had our minds fine-tuned as well around competing, training, how competing is 90% mental and 10% physical, whereas training is 90% physical and 10% mental. So it's, you know, very interesting how all of those things kind of came together between the ages of 18 to 22. One thing Americans do is they really treat you like professionals. That's the reason why I went out there. You know, you are out there to swim. You are out there to be the best athlete you can be. And you are responsible for doing everything in your power to make sure that you exceed your own expectations. So, yeah, it's all consuming, but I would do it all again if I could. You know, it was the best experience ever. I would do it all again, but I actually wouldn't put my child through it. So that's a whole other conversation, like, I think, to have.
That's really interesting. I remember chatting to Tom Gregory, who was officially, and it still is, the youngest person to ever swim the Channel, because they've now changed the age, how old you have to be to do that. And it was really interesting talking to him about how much he appreciated the community spirit behind getting him to be able to do that challenge when he was, I think, like, very young, but also how much he wouldn't put his children through that now. And it's interesting to hear you say the same. And I'm so struck by the commitment and dedication that that must take. And really what you kind of sounds like you went through physically, incredibly impressive, but then also the mental effort. Is that something that you feel like you still use a lot today? I guess you must have a real growth mindset.
Oh, totally. It's so funny because I've been retired 7 years now, 7 years in March, and it gets me every time. I just can't believe it. But what's really funny about having been an elite athlete and then you become what we call like a normal citizen is that like your body changes, you become normal, you have to learn how to love this new version of yourself, which is softer and less fit and less shapely. But what doesn't change, or what hasn't changed for me and a few of my friends who swam with me, was our mindset. I'm still, like I mentioned before, I'm extremely competitive. I hate losing. I know how to lose. That doesn't mean I like it at all. And a lot of the stuff I learned from swimming that was harnessed, you know, my persistence, my drive, my time management, learning how to persevere, all of that I use on a daily basis at work. I actually went from retiring from swimming straight into working at the BBC. And I think it was a really great transition that I had from coming out of such a competitive environment and being able to channel everything I learned into a similarly competitive environment, but one that was very different. You know, journalism requires a lot of patience, and swimming is a sport that you train all hours of the day just to shave off seconds. Like, you need patience to be a successful swimmer. In the same way that if you want to be a reporter, you have to do your time, you have to grind, you have to do night shifts, you have to produce, you have to beat the reporter next to you who's also trying to break the same story on the same deadline. So it's a lot. I guess the mindset for me has never really changed. And I'm grateful. I don't really want my mindset to change because it's gotten me here so far. So, yeah.
How do you lose?
How do I lose?
Tell me about being a good loser.
Being a good loser is appreciating that someone was better than you that day and appreciating that maybe you didn't do everything you could have done to come out on top, evaluating why that is and what you need to do to make sure that doesn't happen again. And I rate winners, you know, I rate people who beat me because I believe if you beat me, you deserve to beat me. There are very few occasions where I think you can get, or I've been outbeaten because of luck. I'm aware things don't go your way, but usually people will put in the time and the effort to perform as they should. But yeah, it's about learning from it. If you don't learn from your loss, then you failed. So as long as you take that, learn from that result, then losing is fine, you know?
I'm really inspired by that because I think, right, evaluating that and having appreciation for what it means to be a winner in that moment is really important. And I think also if we put down to luck too much, not only do we not understand what we can do to improve, but we also don't give ourselves credit where it's due. Because I think sometimes when you come out on top, it's important to be able to recognize that and congratulate yourself for that, for that hard-earned moment. Do you find it hard to do things and not take them seriously? Do you find it hard to not view everything? You know, you mentioned that you're competitive, but when you get, I mean, even down to swimming or just doing new projects, do you find it difficult? I, you know, was organizing a hen do recently. And I find it very hard to not be a perfectionist. And I can't imagine how much you have that, having come from your experience.
Yeah, I mean, this ranges from like family games at Christmas, of like who's in the bag of Monopoly, to being, you know, having a career change and being a producer and saying to the person recruiting me, like, I want to be the best narrative producer in the country. Like, it just doesn't really fade for me. And don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean I haven't had bouts. You know, I've had times where I've wanted to hand everything over for good and just lay in bed forever. And I've had bouts where I'm just tired. I think being an athlete and having this mindset is tiring, but it doesn't go away. You know, you have to find, I was very nervous after I retired from swimming. I had a pretty low 6 months because my identity, I felt like my identity had gone. You know, at the beginning of this podcast, you asked me how I identify, like how I introduce myself. Well, for the first 20 odd years of my life, I would say, my name is Saren and I'm a swimmer. And then when that went away, I just didn't know what my purpose was at all. So it was really difficult to be motivated about anything. So there are those periods where you just don't want to do anything. But I think as long as you have those bursts of competitiveness or motivation, and it all comes from passion, you just have to find something you love. I had to find something that I loved just as much as swimming. And it took some time. But once you find that thing that fills that gap in your heart, then the competitive, then all that drive, all that stuff comes back to you, you know. So
sounds like you've really done the work to get there. I loved hearing you talk about how this new dream of being able to go to university in America and study that. And I think having that shift in perspective is really takes work to do that. And I was struck earlier that you said, oh, I was a dreamer, which is interesting to me. Do you still kind of not think you? I sometimes feel a bit almost embarrassed to have big dreams. Sometimes embarrassed is the wrong word, but I think sometimes it may be a little bit like, who am I to say that? Who am I to say I want to win the Booker one day? Who am I? And I'm trying to be better at, even if not to other people, being able to look at myself in the mirror and say something that I want to do. Because how am I ever going to do it if I'm not able to confront myself and say, I have this dream and I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Still feel like that about things?
Yeah, I think naturally we just know a bit better, don't we? Like, we grow up and we know what it's like to dream big and what it takes to actually make the dream a reality. I think it's fine to be a big dreamer. I still am. But I think as you get older, your feet are on the ground. You know, when you're a kid, your head is in the clouds and your feet are nowhere close to the ground whatsoever. But now the perspective is a bit different. It's like, you know that your feet are still sturdy in there, or there's one foot there and there's one foot that's up. And it's just a more realistic perspective of, okay, this is a monster that I'm thinking of. How am I going to tackle the monster? What steps can I take to make sure that I am safe, I am guarded, I am happy, and that I can take it on, really? I think big dreamers have, all big dreamers have an experience of dreaming big and getting hurt. Like, you know, we didn't realize how high up we were floating, and then you come down and you crash and it hurts and you're injured for a while and maybe you're put off and you're scared. But like, that's kind of what life is about, without getting really philosophical. But I think life is about taking risks and trying. And my parents always said, like, it's better to try than not, you know, like, you do not want to be living this life with any regrets, wondering, what if I tried that one thing, or what if I said yes to that opportunity? That's how a lot of success comes about, just by chance and by trying and impulse. So yeah, I think it's still important to dream big, 100%. And it gets easier to not do that as we get older, when we settle down and security seems more appealing. All things which are very important, but it's important to still have an element of that fearlessness that you have when you're a kid, you know?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that your parents sound like they give very good advice.
Oh, shout out to my parents. I love them so much. So lucky.
Especially your dad giving you advice. I could imagine him giving you pep talks while you're in the car at 5
exactly,
a.m.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's really special. And I think often it can be embarrassing to think, it's interesting that I'm using the word embarrassing so much. I think, if I tell people that I want to do this or achieve something and then I don't do it, people will know. But I think I'm really trying to hold myself to being a trier and giving something a go. And I'd always rather try and reach for something. And I think that's a really cool part of my personality that I'm trying not to shy away from, rather than making my dreams small because they're going to be more achievable. So right about how it is very tempting to get more secure and safe as we get older with what we're reaching for.
Yeah, totally. I set myself this goal a few years ago where I wanted to do one thing a year that scared me. And it can be as big or as little as I want, but it just has to be scary because I'm nearly 30 and it just gets really hard to make scary decisions sometimes. You know, like we're actually trying to move away from scaring ourselves, which has its pros, but also has its cons. So yeah, I've done a couple things that were really big that scared me and that for some people think are really small and they scared me. And I think it's just like a good practice to just remind yourself like I can do this, you know, I can do it. I have every reason to do it. So it's just a good reminder. I use it as a good reminder for myself.
I've got a book recommendation for you then. It's by Georgie Codd, which is a good name for a swimmer. And it's called Swim to the Shark. And she was terrified of fish, decided that to overcome her fear, she would go on a trip to swim with dolphins and sharks. And it's so interesting, her confronting her fears, and it's really funny. And she meets lots of people that tell her terrifying stories about diving. And it's a great memoir of fearing something and grasping it and trying to overcome it and what that taught her in life.
Oh, amazing. That's great for her that she did that. I mean, that is literally one of the scariest things you could do, swimming with sharks, for me.
Okay, now I want to talk to you about your documentary and then also founding the Black Swimming Association. So maybe we can chat a little bit about the experiences that led you to writing the documentary Black Girls Don't Swim for the BBC. Was this after you'd been to America?
Yeah, so the timeline is Cardiff from 8 to 18, America from 18 to 21, 22, and then 22 I started at the BBC. I was at the BBC from 22 to 27. So fast forward to 2019, and I'm working for the World Service Radio, and there's a commission that comes around, some sort of pitch where they say they are commissioning radio documentaries that they want to be niche, from perspectives that haven't really been shared, stories that are new and different. And I'd always had a thought around this idea around Black Girls Not Swimming, but I never really had the time to flesh it out. So this was my chance to do it. So I put in a pitch that was actually centered around my older sister, who I did all of the swimming with. She has quote unquote blacker hair than I do. She's got more Afro hair, kind of like if you believe in the hair categories, she's kind of like a 4B, whereas I'm more in the 3. I've got the looser curls. So when my sister was 16, she decided to give up swimming. She was a really great national swimmer. And I remember being sat on her bed in her room, and she was going back and forth as to why she thinks she's going to give up. And her 3 reasons were, I'm going to start sixth form and I want to study so I can get into a good university. I want to have more of a social life so I can like hang out with my friends. And I want to have good hair. Like, they were the 3 reasons. And I never really understood fully what that meant to have good hair at the time, even though we would straighten our hair whenever we could, whenever we were out of the pool. But I didn't really digest the magnitude of that statement. So that's kind of how I pitched the documentary. It was kind of, where are all the black women? We are extremely dominant in every dry land sport you can list: tennis, track, basketball, netball, everything. We are there, but that dominance doesn't trickle into water sports. So my idea was to investigate why that is. So I published the documentary in the summer of 2019. And off the back of that, I founded the Black Swimming Association. So it all kind of happened quite naturally, although I never would have expected to kind of set up a charity off the back of it. That definitely wasn't part of the plan.
So being, you know, at home, talking to your sister about your experiences swimming and about, you know, her, of course, understandable desire to be a young woman with amazing hair and hanging out with her friends, I guess that must have felt like quite a singular experience then. And then having this documentary, what were the responses like, and how did you go from that shared experience with your sister to realizing this is something that is clearly a problem a lot of people are having and I need to try and get involved and change this?
Well, I guess it felt singular at the time, all those years ago. We're talking nearly 10 years ago, because really my sister and I were two of the top Black female swimmers in Wales, partly because we were like the only ones there. So it did feel singular because I didn't feel the same way. Like I said, my love for swimming trumped the way I looked and trumped my hair. It wasn't until really I went through the American collegiate system as a swimmer, expecting to find more Black girls on the way. I found one of my standard. And one of the things I talk about in the documentary is across my 13-year span of elite swimming, I came across 5 Black girls, and one was my sister. So I can't really count her. It's 4 Black girls. When I did the documentary, I flew out to Washington, D.C. for a couple of reasons. Firstly, there was this competition happening called the Black History Month Invitational. It was in February, where about 800 Black swimmers would fly in from different parts of the country just to race each other, purely because their parents were like, you know, USA Swimming has about 1% of its swimmers who are Black. Our kids don't get enough representation. Let's put them in this meet so they can see themselves represented in an attempt to keep them in the sport, in an attempt to retain them. So that was thing one, where I was like, wow, there are a lot of people here who are fighting to keep their kids in the sport, and hair is a big factor. You know, I met a mother who started her own hairline to protect afro hair because her daughter wanted to quit because of her hair. So people were fighting the fight. And then I also went to Howard University, which is what we call an HBCU, a historical Black college and university. And they're the only HBCU in the country that have a women's swim team. So I interviewed the entire women's swim team, and it was amazing speaking to them. Like, they were all saying about how, yeah, the hair thing is real, and they love off-season because they get the long braids. This is before they were the big swim caps, and they were talking about how it's so good on deck when they're on deck at 5 in the morning, and like, she can't get her afro in her hair, her hair's looking dry and ashy, her skin's looking bad, but like, they're all in it together, and there's representation, so they feel fine. But being the only one in a situation like that can feel really isolating and quite horrible. So even though I thought it was a single experience back when I was a child, actually, it was not. So I came back to the UK wanting to do something. Like, I just wanted to give back in some way. And coincidentally, I received an email in my BBC inbox from a lovely woman called Danielle, who had listened to my documentary and read my article and asked to meet up. She's of Nigerian heritage. She has 3 kids, and she was saying she homeschools them and she takes them to the pool for swimming. And it's the worst thing in the world because the detangling process is just horrific. So Danielle and I met up at one of the malls in London and just chatted for hours. And by the time we went home, we had agreed that we were going to do something to make the community get in the water, really. So that was kind of where the seed was planted for the BSA at Westfield Stratford in Starbucks. And then it wasn't until we brought on the other 2 co-founders that we were kind of ready to actually push this thing out into the world.
That's amazing. I love the power of storytelling, that you made this documentary and then to receive a letter from a stranger who then becomes a friend and a business partner. So tell me about the work that you do together about the BSA, and maybe the kind of 4 co-founders that started it.
Yeah, of course. So there are 4 of us co-founders who, at the beginning, we were all just strangers. Our common ground was that we were all Black, African, and all had some sort of relationship with swimming. So I was an ex-elite swimmer. I interviewed Alice Deering as part of, not the documentary, but the spin-off article that I published at the time. And she still is the only Black woman on Team GB. She became one of our co-founders. Danielle, who is currently the chair of the charity, is what we would call a swim mum in the aquatic world, where her kids swim, but she doesn't really. And then Ed is our final co-founder, the only male who was already doing his own individual work to raise awareness around the conversation of Black people not swimming. So the 4 of us came together and decided to put all our resources together and actually make change, you know, change the narrative and actually see what we could really do if we put all of our eggs into this one basket to try to get people who look like us to take swimming and water safety seriously. So The charity is 3 years old now, which I can't believe because it's my baby. And Danielle and I call it our toddler. You know, she literally texted me today and she was like, the toddler is running around and it's stressing me out. We literally just talk about the BSA as if it's a real life little human between us. But it's been, you know, so magnificent seeing how much the charity has grown, how much traction we've gotten, the funding that we've received, the support that we've gotten on social media, the media attention. You know, we launched 2 weeks before COVID hit, and the aim was to host 2 or 3 clinics a year to get people like my mum, who doesn't really swim, aunties and uncles in the water, getting them safe, feeling comfortable and empowered. But then all the pools closed. So we were like, oh my God, what are we going to do now? So we had to completely change the direction of the charity temporarily. And we went into kind of advocacy, research and policy change. So we kind of did a lot of work with big swimming brands, national governing bodies, Speedo, Swim England, Sport England, the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, to just get a seat at the table, you know, to talk about why we exist, where we feel the need that we have to exist, and what we're going to do about drowning prevention in Black and Asian communities. So it's been quite a long journey. You know, 3 years later, we are putting those original thoughts into action. So we have water safety sessions that we host in the borough of Hackney, and we're expanding to 5 other boroughs, where we teach people in African, Caribbean and Asian communities how to be safe. So it's quite funny because a lot of people assume that we're a swim school, that we have learned to swim classes, but it's not that. We actually talk about, what do you do when you are walking down the canal and you see someone in distress? Do you know who to call? Do you know about cold water shock when you unexpectedly hit the water? Do you know how to breathe around water? You know, a lot of people think that because they can't breathe underwater, they drown. And then we have to tell them, you know, no one can breathe like underwater. Like the mermaids do that. Like that's not, if you open your mouth and breathe in, you will get water in your body and it's not very nice, you know? So we really like break down the basics of, do you know how to be safe? And what's different about how we do it is the teachers, we actually get into the water with them. So we do all of these exercises with them over the course of 5 weeks. And as a byproduct, a lot of them learn how to swim. A lot of them didn't swim before. So it's a really powerful, rewarding, emotional journey that we go on with a lot of these non-swimmers who are aquaphobic, a lot of them, who don't feel as though they have the confidence or right, to be frank, to explore the local aquatic facilities in their local neighborhoods, and who just don't know how to be safe. You know, last night we were with our men's only session, and we know that men between the age of 16 and 34 are the ones who are most likely to drown, Black men, because men cave to peer pressure, drinking and slipping, even suicide. But, you know, last night's session was truly about, we were in the water and we were talking about all of these things. You know, do you know how to stay afloat? What do you do if you do fall in? Float on your back, you turn around, you count to three. You call the Coast Guard, depending on where you are in the country, but maybe you have to call the fire department. So a lot of it is just education. You know, if we can save one life, then we've done our work. And that's really the essence of the charity. It's about drowning prevention.
And that sounds so powerful that people can experience that knowledge and share it with their friends and tell people. And that engagement at local community level is just really inspiring. And what are you doing? You mentioned kind of policy making. What's happening on that side of things? That's super interesting.
So it's been really interesting the last 3 years being in the same rooms as, you know, national governing bodies and swimming brands and charities talking about why people who look like me feel as though the sector has precluded them, intentionally or not, you know. So it's been really fantastic to see the sector respond, to see more pool time being dedicated to specific groups more than ever, you know, to see the evolution of swimwear. We've got modest swimwear now, we've got oversized swim caps, you know, people are really taking different demographics and different populations and different people into consideration when they're designing swimwear, when they're thinking about what an aquatic community looks like. So it's been really great.
No, that's super interesting. I've been really encouraged to see Finisterre doing more like modest surf suits, and obviously everything that Solcap's doing is really exciting, and I hope that it encourages people to get into the water. And I think even just talking about it, I've had a lot of friends recently that have been encouraged to do swimming lessons for the first time, and it makes me so happy to see that excitement. And people can say, oh, it's so silly, I actually can't swim, or it's really embarrassing. And I think it's not at all, because fear of water is a really quite sensible fear, but it's great that the more people are talking about it, there's that encouragement, that movement towards inclusion, which is really great.
Yeah, it's been really fantastic to see how when we first started, the conversations we were having around Black people, especially Black people not swimming, was very awkward. The media found it awkward. Black people found it awkward. White people found it awkward. It was just awkward. And 3 years later, and this isn't just because of us at all, there have been loads of other groups that have popped up, which is fantastic. But it's, you know, these conversations are normalized now. And it's really great to see other groups be empowered to do what they want to do to also add to changing the narrative. That, you know, setting up the BSA, the point wasn't to be the only Black aquatic organization. It's been so lovely seeing the likes of Swim Unity, the likes of Soul Cap, the likes of, you know, all these other groups, Penguins Palace down in Peckham, who are just doing what they feel they need to do in their, you know, regional communities to help, you know. It's really great. I can't believe how many Black and brown people I've seen swimming over the last year, whether they're in commercials or they're in pools or they're, you know, they're in the conversations or they're just engaging in some way, you know. It's been really fantastic. And I'm just, yeah, it's been a crazy journey. I never would have thought we would have done this much and that the narrative would have changed so much. And there's obviously still a long way to go, but a lot of damage has been done. And to have undone so much of that thinking is it's a lot of work. And I'm really proud of everyone who's put in the time to contribute to that.
It's so incredibly impressive and such a huge achievement. And like you say, just the toddler at 3 years has got a life and a journey of its own now, which is just amazing and must be especially fantastic to be in a community where so much great work is continuing to happen, especially in London. And also, I know you mentioned that you're from Cardiff, and I know the BSA has had a partnership with Sport Wales, which yeah. also must be very exciting for you see that yeah. in your hometown.
Amazing. I was so, so, so proud. Sport Wales are fantastic. They're extremely responsive. They want to make change. And they back us, you know, they see the work that we've been doing in Hackney over the last year with our water safety sessions, and we'll be replicating those sessions across the M4 corridor, which is Cardiff, Newport and Swansea. And yeah, just bringing the BSA home to like to where I'm from and where my swim journey really started for me means the world. Like it's just phenomenal. You know, I've had messages from people who I used to swim with saying, we want help, or, you know, how can we contribute? You know, what do you need? And seeing those people who I, you know, knew when I was a kid get it and understand and want to buy in, it just really means the world. So, yeah, it's really great.
I'm always saying that swimming is such a welcoming and friendly community. And it's great to hear that it's like that at an activism level, that everyone's like, what can I do to help? And even hearing about how involved your parents were with your swimming journey, and now hearing that you've got Danielle, who's like the next generation of swim mum, also being like that, is so cool that it's so supportive and warming. And I think in general, the world can be quite a scary place right now. And especially when you're on Twitter, everything feels very intense. And I always want to say to people, go to the poolside, go to the Lido, go to the ponds, and you will find that the world and the community that a lot of people want is here. And people are kind to each other, and people are not always arguing. People want to look out for one another.
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, we frame swimming differently depending on the groups we work with in terms of their age, you know. But one thing that is relevant to anybody is swimming is a de-stressor. It's really good for your mental health. And you're so right. The world has been the scariest of places for many Brits over the last few years with the pandemic. And, you know, if you need to get away from all the crazy, and there's a lot of crazy out there, it's amazing what water can do. You know, you can literally, as you know, you can have all the concerns, uncertainties, fears in the world. You can feel like your world is literally crumbling. And then you get into a pool and you come out and it all just kind of like melts away. And you're like, okay, let's go. We can start again. It's fine. So yeah, we always try to tell our participants that this is good for your mind, you know. And on top of that, you know, there are still taboos that exist within the Black and Asian communities around mental health. So if we can help with that, that's fantastic. If we can also prevent you from having to be on some type of medication, that's also great. And if we can help the NHS by relieving pressure, then there's another bonus, you know. So swimming can it can provide so much for your mental health and well-being. And that's without me even talking about the physical the physical benefits, which I'm sure you know all about as well. So yeah, it's got a lot of benefits.
Yeah, I'm so excited about the NHS trials that are happening at the moment in Sussex, prescribing people swimming and swimming in groups and for community.
That's amazing.
I've been emailing them with all kinds of encouragement, and hopefully we're going to be chatting to them when they have their findings later
amazing.
This summer.
That'd be perfect, yeah.
Yeah, I'm so excited and really pleased to see that the NHS are kind of getting involved with what amazing actions we can have for mental health. And I wanted to chat to you a little bit more about Wales, because my parents live in Wales, not far from Newport, and I love swimming there, but wild swimming. So I love river around Crickhowell. That's a great place to swim. And also Keeper's Pond. Have you ever, tell me about some of the places that you swim in Wales.
You know what? I haven't swam in such a long time because, contrary to popular belief, pool swimmers can very much be like indoor creatures and pool swimmers. So I didn't get into open water swimming really until COVID because the pools were closed. Now, this doesn't mean that I don't go to the beach when I'm abroad. Like you know, no one can drag me away from the beach when I'm in a hot climate. But we don't have that here. You have to be quite thick skinned to get into like outdoor spots and enjoy them. So back home, my favorite place to swim is this place in Penarth called The Knapp. It's kind of a pebble beach and it's just lovely. It's just like, it's such good respite. You know, you can paddleboard there. You can swim. You can just do a bit of a doggy paddle and get out, but it's lovely. And it used to be like a really well-kept secret in Cardiff a few years ago. And my parents go, gosh, on a monthly basis. But now it's getting really, really popular. And they've got a nice strip of restaurants. They've got some apartments there, but it's really precious. I think when you find those places that serve you in that way, that make you better and that allow you to switch off from reality, whether it's for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, you really have to hold on to those places. They're so good for you. You know, they're good for your soul. So The Knapp is where I would go. My parents might be angry that I've said that on a big podcast now. Everyone flocks over to The Knapp in Penarth, but it is truly wonderful.
Thank you for the recommendation. It's always a tricky one of feeling a little bit protective of places and not wanting them to become busy, but also being so happy when you see people out enjoying gorgeous weather. I love Tenby in Wales. That's a beautiful place to swim. And we went there as children, and then recently me and my mum have gone back, and I took a friend recently, and we just had to take someone new, and then it become a special place for them, and to share that is really nice.
Oh, that's so lovely. Tenby is so popular, you know. It's, I mean, so much of Wales is gorgeous. You know, you could swim anywhere on the coast and have a great time. You know, we've got you know, Anglesey right at the top, the island there. You've got Pembrokeshire. You've got on the northwest coast, you've got like Abersoch, and then in Cardiff, you've got, you know, you're 45 minutes away from Porthcawl and Rest Bay where you can surf. So we're really lucky in Wales to have lots of water at our doorstep. Really, I just hope that in years to come, more people feel as though they can just go for a day with a family, or like, why not just pop down to the beach, or why not drive up to the reservoir, you know? So they're for everyone. Everyone should be able to have the right to enjoy them.
And I know you've been swimming a little bit in London, maybe West Reservoir. You've also been to Jamaica. Tell me about some memorable swims recently. And I always think it's interesting to try and talk about swimming and try and find words for something that feels so magical and spiritual. Tell me a little bit about a recent swim that you've been on.
Oh gosh, okay. Well, I just got back from Jamaica about a week ago, and it was my first time going to the country. I'd been to the Caribbean before, but never to the island. And it's funny, I was speaking to a colleague the other day and he was like, oh, I saw your video of your holiday. I put a lot of effort for you into making this reel about Jamaica. And it basically was just me and water, really, the whole time. I was there for about 8 days. And I said, when I was there, I really recognized how privileged I was to be able to run towards the edge of a cliff, jump off and land in blue water, to the point where it makes me quite emotional. Like when I'm very stressed and I go swimming, I tend to cry. I call it like leaking, because it's not like, you're not like, wah! But like you can feel the tears coming and you just have to lean into it and embrace it. But there was a time where I jumped off this cliff and I was like floating in the sea. They'd basically cordoned off a part of the sea as if it's like a man-made pool. And I was floating on my back and I was just like, this is surreal. You know, like this, as important as it is as a life-saving skill, it's just as important to be able to give the experience I just had of pure bliss that was just so divine. I want people to be able to experience that, because when you get it, you get it. And when we have our participants, you know, from week one, where some of them are on poolside crying because they're petrified of getting in, but by week five, they're like, oh, I've got to dip my head in, I'm so stressed, or I just need to get in the pool. It's like they get it. They understand the benefits that it has. They understand that it's a safe space and that it can just make you the best version of yourself. So I was very fortunate to be in Jamaica for about 8 days where I got to do that. I was bopping between infinity pools and coastal beaches and Negril, which is a town of a 7 mile beach stretch. And the water was turquoise and it was just magical. It was one of those moments where you thought, if I were to die tomorrow, I would die happy. And it's quite a strange thought. But when you're in a place of pure content, you just think, okay, I've had a good life. I'm good. I could tap out now. I'm good. You know?
I'm so happy to hear that you feel, not only that you feel like that, but also that you're able to be on a journey where you're introducing people to that feeling and that how transformative that is. And I think, you know, you're talking about people getting it. And I think people get it at a really deep level. It's kind of beyond, you can read about the science of why swimming is good for you, but you really understand it quite deeply. I think there's something about it being held. You know, you mentioned crying, and I think it's because as adults, we don't get to really be held much. And then when you're in the water, you're being hugged, supported, and it's so freeing. We all need that a little bit more.
Yeah, totally. It's funny. I think it resonates for all types of swimmers. You know, I love teaching adults because adults understand the psychology behind it. And when they get it, it's so powerful and rewarding. But even for competitive swimmers, you know, there's a trope that like you cry in your goggles. Like you just do that because life is stressful and it's private and it's intimate and people can't really see. So the water holds so many secrets. It's amazing. You know, like people can confide in it and you leave what you need to leave in there and then you get out and you're a different person. You're an enhanced person. So it truly is. It's so safe. It's such a safe place. If you understand how to treat it well, it can be the safest of places, I think.
The water holds so many secrets. What a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for joining me, Saren.
Thank you so much for having me.
So that was Saren. I hope you enjoyed our chat. Don't forget that you could pre-order my book, The Tidal Year, wherever you buy your books. It really helps. Now, this is the last episode of season 2, and next week I have something special, a bonus episode that's going to be an extract from the beginning of my audiobook. I'm really excited to share it, and I hope that you enjoy it. Thanks again to this episode's sponsor, TryHard. Say goodbye to chlorine and shop their skin and hair products at 15% off with the code TIDAL. See you next week!